This is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, a program where we share revealing, in-depth conversations with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. Tonight, a conversation with architectural and interior design expert, Vern Yip. A recent poll of builders, architects, and remodelers reflected some optimism in the industry with slow positive growth in construction. The most growth is forecast in the residential remodeling area, as opposed to more move-ups or luxury custom home construction. So how does the current economy impact the size, design, and even choice of materials used in new homes and remodeling? What are some of the changes we might see in home design, both exterior and interior, in the next few years? This is Valerie Jackson, and joining me today in Conversation to talk about some of these new design trends and much, much more is noted architect and designer Vern Yip. He's one of the most celebrated designers today, one of HGTV's favorite personalities. From the popular Trading Spaces series and NBC's Home Intervention to HGTV's Bang for Your Buck and his own show titled Deserving Design, providing the gift of design to some very deserving souls. 2012 was his seventh season of HGTV's Design Star, and Vern is frequently seen on The Today Show, The Early Show, CNN, and others, as well as being frequently featured in The New York Times, Entertainment Weekly, and USA Today. He's a past recipient of Southern Magazine's Distinguished Southerner Award and the Veranda Magazine's Southeast Designer of the Year. Well, since I've been thinking of some design changes in my own home, I've been looking forward to picking the brain of this guest. I am certainly delighted to welcome Vern Yip, and thank you so much for being with us today, Vern.
Well, thank you for having me. I mean, I can't tell you what an honor it is to be interviewed by you.
Ah, thank you. Well, then let's just get right to it. Vern, your background would probably surprise most. Undergrad degrees in economics and chemistry, an MBA, a master's in architect. You've worked as an architect and designer, but what prompted that transition earlier from business and science to a career in design?
It's kind of a funny story. My parents were immigrants who came to this country after fleeing communist China during the Cultural Revolution. And anybody who has Chinese parents knows that they basically tell you, you have two choices in life. You can grow up and you can become a doctor, or you can grow up and you can become a doctor. So it was pretty clear to me early on that my path was going to be to, you know, become a physician. And so I was always a very dutiful son. I was never that child to rebel. I always just wanted to make my parents proud. And so when I went to the University of Virginia to do my undergraduate studies, I was a pre-med student, and so I focused a lot of time on the sciences and, of course, chemistry, and I got the economics degree as well to kind of give myself something solid to land on. It wasn't that I had this incredible passion for economics. It was just that I wanted to have a degree that I knew I could do something with that my parents approved of. But my entire life, I've always known, and my parents have too, that I'm a creative person. And really, I am that person who came out of the womb knowing what they were supposed to become in life. Mm-hmm. I've always designed. When I was a little boy, I was always playing with Legos and never interested in building cars or airplanes. I was always building houses. I was building office buildings, and it was just something that I was passionate about from the very beginning. So 2 weeks before medical school was about to start, I finally confessed to my mother. I said, you know, I can't do this. I feel like, I am looking down the barrel of a gun. And my passion and my heart is really in architecture. It's really in design. And so, you know, it's the story of my life. She's always just been so supportive. She passed away 6 years ago, but, you know, she always, my entire life, supported me in whatever it is I was passionate about. And if I had voiced it earlier, she would have supported it as well. But I just was always fearful to do that. And so she said, great, go do it. I know you'll dedicate yourself to doing the best job possible with it. And so I ended up not going to medical school, but ended up applying to go to graduate school down at Georgia Institute of Technology at Georgia Tech, where I got my Master's of Architecture. And I was one of the very first students to do a dual master's program there, where I was getting my Master's of Architecture and my MBA at the same time.
Wow.
And I was very, very lucky, because basically how it worked is I would have my core curriculum classes planned out for architecture school, and I would run to the business school office, and then they would plan the schedule for the business school around when I had to take my architecture classes.
Wow.
Because I was a guinea pig of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think it's a formalized program, but they made it possible for me to get both of those degrees in 3 years. And I was always so so grateful.
Wow.
Grateful to have their support, and grateful to be going to a school that was, you know, really excelled in those two areas. So that's how I ended up making that transition.
Well, they say, or I've heard or I've read somewhere, that a good designer is a combination of an engineer and an artist. So evidently you've got that combination. But let's talk about the relationship between architecture and design. How is it that architecture affects design? And give me an example if you can.
Well, it's so funny that to me that those two disciplines are more often than not studied separately, and that there isn't more overlap in school, because in real life, those two areas really need to work together to pull off a successful project. And having this really strong architectural background has made me a better designer, because when we traditionally work on projects for the built environment, architects design buildings and they design houses, and they design them without thinking about where the furniture is going to go and how people are actually going to move around in the space. And interior designers then come and they space plan based on what the architect has done, and oftentimes it doesn't quite work in an ideal fashion. So for me, it's been a huge advantage having both areas in my life, because I understand as a designer, you know, how buildings need to come together. And when I'm doing something from an architectural perspective, I always keep in mind how space planning is going to happen and where the furniture is going to go and how someone's going to inhabit that space. So for me, I've always found it really odd that those two disciplines are so separate.
You've used the phrase space planning. That really kind of brings up one of my next question, which is the difference between an interior designer and an interior decorator.
Yeah, it's something that a lot of people use those two titles interchangeably, but they actually are very different. And I don't think that one is really better than
right.
the other. It's just that they're different. An interior designer has to sit and take what's called the NCIDQ, which is the National Council of Interior Design Qualifications. It's a multi-part examination that tests you on a variety of things that will then allow you to work in the commercial sector. So, you know, I am an interior designer. I've sat and taken the NCIDQ, and in order to sit and take it, you have to have either an interior design degree or an architectural degree. You have to intern for several years under a registered interior designer to get your hours to qualify to sit and take the test. An interior decorator doesn't need to have a degree in any sort of design. An interior decorator also can only work in the residential area for the most part.
So is it because she is focusing when they say interior decorating on more of the arrangements and the aesthetics as opposed to the design of the space, which maybe the interior designer does?
Well, the jobs overlap a lot, especially mm-hmm. in the residential arena. Mm-hmm. An interior designer usually has, in order to take the NCIDQ and pass it, an interior designer needs to have knowledge of things like the ADA code, you know, the American Disabilities Act, and they need to understand how they need to understand what materials can actually be utilized in a commercial space that are fire safe, that will endure traffic. And
right.
it's a lot
right.
of knowledge of code.
Let's talk about the power of design to affect people's lives. For instance, the recent recession that we've had, did that impact design in any way with respect to what people might have favored or the trends?
Yeah, I mean, everything I think has been impacted by what's happened with the economy. And what we've seen is that a lot of people who haven't had the ability to move either to a bigger house or a smaller house or just a different house have just taken the approach that, okay, if I'm going to be stuck here living in this house, I'm going to make the most of my space. I'm going to try and turn it into something that that I'm happy with and that I can live with, and I need to be able to do it economically. You know, I don't want to give up quality, but I don't want to spend a lot to get there either. So there's been a big change in terms of how we as designers work in this kind of environment. We need to be much more sensitive to the fact that people do have much bigger responsibilities mm-hmm. out there. I mean, they still need to put food on the table at the end of the day. They still have to pay their mortgage at the end of the day and send their kids to school and get them dressed. And so you see how much farther down the ladder something
right,
like redesigning
right.
your house yeah. Falls. But to me, I have always felt, and this has been a mainstay of my career, is that whether you have, you know, $500 or you have $5,000 or you have $50,000 or $500, whatever it is that you have to work with, if you plan carefully, you can utilize those funds to make very smart decisions that then create big changes in your environment.
Did you see any what might be called psychological reactions with respect to whether they would pick straight lines over flowery fabrics or whether colors were more bold during recession or less bold?
Immediately after the economy began to fall, people's immediate reaction was to go for everything super safe. So we saw a lot of neutrals, a lot of beige, a lot of tan, a lot of camel, a lot of gray. People really wanted to retreat to whatever was safe. And after several years of that, even when the economy wasn't necessarily getting better, people just kind of got tired of feeling tired. They got tired of looking at beige walls, mm-hmm. and they wanted some color in their lives to help them feel better about things. And so you started seeing, the Pantone color of the year becoming, these bright colors like honeysuckle, which is a pink with a red undertone, or tangerine tango, which was the big one that we just experienced, which was orange with a red undertone. It was just anything that was bright and vibrant that was going to like lift your spirits.
We'll be back in conversation with HGTV's Vern Yip in just a moment. This is Valerie Jackson in conversation with interior designer Vern Yip. His accomplishments include his own line of interior decor products to hosting the HGTV feel-good series Deserving Design, where he redesigns two rooms in the homes of deserving people who are identified as being in need. In this next part of In Conversation, I asked him how he came to create his own design practice here in Atlanta. Well, your own design company here, Vern Yip Designs, has been very successful. What do you see, though, in the industry, or what was it that you didn't see in the industry that made you want to start your own firm? And how is it that your firm is differentiating itself from the, many, many other design firms? Is there a niche that you found or that you were looking for?
I don't get to do too many private client projects anymore between you know, all the television work, right. And I have my own line at Home Shopping Network. Between all of that kind of stuff, I don't get the opportunity to take on too many private client projects, but I like to do at least a couple private client projects a year. And I think that my perspective has always been, number one, I don't need to have somebody walk into a space and say, oh, this is a Vern Yip space. I'm not necessarily looking to create a signature look. What I'm trying to do is give people quality space, space that's a physical manifestation of who they are, but the best possible version of what it is that they love and what it is that makes them happy. You know, any successful space for me has to be the confluence of function and aesthetics. It has to be those two things coming together. And I always start my process by sitting down and really listening carefully. I think it's one of the most important tools that we have as designers is the ability to listen and to hear what is important to the person that you are doing the project for. How is it that they live in that space? What do they love? What is it that they don't love? And really then helping them to manifest that space or those spaces within their clearly outlined budget. Mm-hmm. Like we were just saying, you know, whether you have a small budget or a large budget, whatever budget it is that you're working for, I want to stretch that budget out to maximum effect. I want it to look like you milked every single penny out of that budget. And that you are appreciating it and getting to experience it. And so that's my goal with every project.
I found a quote by you. It's something that I was reading in it. And your quote was, anybody can do high quality and anybody can do great design, but it's really hard to do those things and still make it accessible to everyone. So does that mean that you do it in an affordable manner?
I try to because if it, you know, for me, I have a different definition of what it means to be affordable. I want people to have a long-term point of view with their interiors, meaning it's very, very easy if you have a tight budget to go out there and knock out everything that's on your list. But at the end of the day, does that mean that you have things that are going to live with you, that are going to endure the test of time, that are going to, you know, do you have a sofa that you can sit on for years and years and years to come and that's going to be with you for life even after you reupholster it? I just want people to make the smartest decisions possible that are going to end up saving them the most money possible without giving up quality. And sometimes that means, you know, maybe not getting everything done immediately, but it means being able to ask the right questions. For example, when you buy a sofa, do you know whether or not your sofa has a hardwood frame or a softwood frame? If it has a softwood frame, it's likely not going to last very long. So ask that question. Do you know what the structure of the cushions are? Is it a spring bed? Is it an 8-way hand-tied spring, or is it just foam? I mean, if it's just foam, it might feel comfortable in the store and it might look good for the first month, but then you're going to start noticing where it is that you've been sitting every single time. It's not going to bounce back. And I think that we all get used to the idea that when we buy something like a sofa, we walk into the store, we see what appeals to us visually, and then we sit on it. Is it comfortable? Well, yeah, it might look great for those first couple of months, but after you get it home, you know, I want that piece of furniture that's going to continue to serve you. And so I just want people to make smart decisions. I want them to make the best decisions possible so at the end of the day, they aren't spending more money than they need to long term.
Well, tell me, how do we decide if we should remodel or if we should just go ahead and just rebuild, new construction? Where's the line between? Is there a determining factor or are there determining factors that say, well, after this point, you should just consider building?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is where having that economics degree and having that business degree has really helped. You know, for me, I think it's a very logical decision. If you need your home to be an investment and you're not just rolling in so much money that you can just do what you want, you need to start by doing an analysis of where your home is located. You know, what what are the standards in my neighborhood? What are the comparative sales in my neighborhood? If I put X number of dollars into my home through a remodel, am I going to get those dollars back? And when people shop for a home in my neighborhood, what are their expectations? Are there expectations that, you know, that it's a four-bedroom house with 3.5 baths, or is it smaller or larger? You know, what you want to do, and I think this is the situation most people in this country are in, is that they need their homes to be an investment. They need to be able to, at some point, sell it and sell it for a profit. And to be able to put yourself in that position, you have to start by making a really really good analysis of your neighborhood, and to contact a realtor and just sort of figure out, where does my house fall within the whole standard of this thing?
So what are some of the major changes we might see in home design in the next couple of years? Well, I guess I'm saying let's talk about trends. I know I keep hearing words like eco-friendly, universal design, flexible rooms. So let's talk a little bit about these new trends, if you will.
Well, I mean, having homes built in a greener fashion is definitely something that I think has become really important. Not every market is willing to pay for it. And sometimes it can be more expensive to do. There might be more upfront cost, but your operating costs could be lower in the long run.
No, you back up a minute. You said not all markets would pay for it. What did you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that in some parts of this country, people get really excited about the idea that their house is green, that it's been built with eco-friendly principles, and that's really important to them. In other parts of the country, it's just not as important. People would rather pay less for a house that, you know, wasn't necessarily built using eco-friendly principles than pay more because it is eco-friendly or green. So it just depends on the part of the country that you live in and what is important, and that's always something that's, you know, critical to understand when you're looking to buy or sell in the housing market.
What about the reuse of old buildings? You know, the factories being turned into lofts. Are we still seeing a lot of that, or has that kind of slowed down?
No, I think that we're starting to see that happen again. Okay. It did sort of take a hit when the economy was really, down in the dumps, and we're really seeing housing pick up tremendously. And we're also seeing the rehab of existing buildings pick up as well. It was a huge trend before the economy sort of went south. Mm-hmm. But everything is looking much sunnier and much brighter when it comes to housing in general. We were seeing for a while, the past 2 to 3 years, the size of the average house go down in terms of square footage. People were wanting smaller houses, which was a reversal of the trend where houses were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And we began to see people really instead wanting to have homes that were much more manageable, where they could control the cost of energy bills, where they could control, you know, they just didn't need to have all that square footage that people were wanting before. Now, I think we're going to maybe start seeing that reverse again. And I think that it's always just sort of a product of where we are with the economy. As people are feeling stronger about things and better about things, they start to feel like, oh, maybe I do need that extra guest bedroom. Maybe I do need that extra bathroom.
So the McMansion is not dead?
I don't think that it's gone for good. I don't.
What about connecting to the outdoors? We see a lot of emphasis now about bringing the outdoors inside.
I think it's been something that people have really loved from the beginning, and I think it's always going to be something that people strive for. This idea that we are spending so much more time outdoors than we used to. And we now have furniture, we have fabrics, we have all kinds of things that have been developed to the point where they can live outside year-round.
You're right. I walk through the stores and sometimes I'm looking over into the garden area and I see furniture that someone could be putting in their living room. I mean, it looks so good.
And I've done that for clients. I've used outdoor fabrics for indoor furniture because that fabric is that much more durable. It's mold resistant. It's stain resistant. It's fade resistant.
Right.
And they've developed it to the point where it's just as soft as any indoor fabric that you would consider in the first place. So so outdoor living has become huge.
The trend I read earlier was going toward remodeling. And do you have any advice on financing when someone wants to do a major renovation or design? Is there a particular way to go? Do you get a second mortgage? Do you get a separate loan? Any recommendation on that?
I think everybody's got to have a firm grasp on their specific situation, their specific financial situation first, because I think that the right answer to that is going to be different for everybody. So you have to have a firm grasp on your financials first. Then I think after you have a firm grasp on your financials, you have to have a firm grasp on your area and figure out what is the smartest thing for you to do if you're going to remodel. And you also have to have a good understanding of why you are remodeling. Am I remodeling in order to sell my house at some point in the near future in a 5 to 10 year horizon? Or am I remodeling because I just want to remodel and this is the house that I plan on living out my last years and I really don't care, you know, if I have to put it on the market or not? Those are two very, very different kinds of decisions, and they inform how you remodel. You know, am I going to remodel my kitchen, for example, in a way that's going to be most desirable for the neighborhood that I'm in, the kind of kitchen that everybody coming to this neighborhood wants to see? Or am I just going to follow my heart and my passion and do what it is that I've always wanted to do so I can have my dream kitchen?
Well, you've got it financed, the new home or the remodeling. But so what's the very first thing, Vern, that you look at or that you think about when you go inside that home to design?
The very first thing for me is always having a firm grasp on what it is that my clients need. What's important to them? What's important to them from a functional standpoint? What's important to them from an aesthetic standpoint? How are they going to live in this house? That has to be the initial seed. You know, everything comes from that. And if you don't start from that place, then you're not going to ever have that super successful project.
Well, you know what I want to do? Just kind of visit a couple of rooms and talk about a few of the trends that we might be seeing. For instance, in the kitchen. I read that the kitchen is the new living room. Is that true?
Yes. Really? Well, it has been true for a long time. You know, it's, and everybody knows this, when you throw a party, where does everybody end up? In the kitchen. It's where everybody wants to be. I mean, of course, it's where the food is. It's where the beverages are.
So what are we doing in the kitchen these days that makes it even more livable? What is there a particular material? Is there a particular choice of seating?
I think the one thing about the kitchen is that it has become bigger and bigger. We've seen living rooms become smaller. We've seen formal dining rooms become smaller and sometimes completely disappear altogether. But the kitchen is that one room along with the master bathroom that has become bigger and bigger. Master bathrooms and kitchens have grown tremendously in size. And I think that is a response to where people spend time and where they feel, you know, those important moments in their life happening. People want a master bathroom that feels big and luxurious, and they want their own sink, and they want a big shower. And the same thing goes for the kitchen. You know, they realize that that's where everybody ends up. It's where kids a lot of times do homework. So they want that kitchen to be generous.
But, you know, remodeling the kitchen, which I've learned the hard way, it's a little bit different from any other room. So what are the precautions that we should take, or the caveats in kitchen remodeling?
Well, the kitchen is one of the most difficult spaces in a house to design because you really absolutely have to get the functional component right. If you don't get the functional component right, it does not matter at all how beautiful your cabinets are and how wonderful those countertops are. You have to make sure that your appliances are the appliances that are going to work for you and that they are laid out in a way that makes that kitchen as efficient for you to cook in as possible. Now, all that goes out the window if you're not a cook. And a lot of people use a kitchen just to store their delivery, you know, their Chinese food delivery or whatever. But it's very important if you actually use your kitchen for cooking purposes or for entertaining purposes.
What do you think is the most neglected aspect of kitchen design?
I would say probably countertops. People need to know that countertops are the workhorse of the kitchen. You can save a lot of money in a lot of areas of your kitchen, but the countertops are not a place where you should just sort of, you know, go for second or third rate. You should get the countertops that are going to work for you. You have to, you know, one of the big trends we're seeing with countertops right now are white marble countertops. If you open any design magazine, you see a white kitchen cabinet with beautiful white marble countertops and subway style white backsplash. And the thing is, they are gorgeous, and I'm about to remodel my kitchen, and I will probably put those in. But I'm not a big cook, and the white marble countertops are really soft. They will absorb stains. They are sensitive to any sort of acidity. If you have tomatoes that you're cutting, or you have red wine, or anything like that, they are a lot more maintenance than some other alternatives that you could pick. So, but for me, you know, for the amount of cooking that I do, I think they'll be perfect.
If the kitchen is the new living room, then what's happening to the old living room?
The old living room, it has basically disappeared from a lot of people's houses. We are so past the days where the living room was, you know, quote unquote, the museum of the house, and it was reserved for company, and it's where all the most expensive, precious things in your house went, and it was just basically a display area. Nowadays, people want to use every room in their house. So if the living room exists, people have in most people's homes, at least, reconsidered, you know, what actually goes in. They want it to be functional. They want it to be a room that you can appreciate every day and that you can utilize every day. And there's no reason why it can't be that. You can still have really beautiful furniture that is usable, and it doesn't feel so precious.
So I could turn my living room into maybe an art studio if I'm not entertaining guests.
Well, we encourage people to do that all the time.
Really?
As designers. And I always say that because the formal dining room usually has some proximity to the kitchen.
Right.
And so for many people, especially with young kids, they maybe use a formal dining room two or three times a year at most, but they need that playroom for the kids. They need a place for, you know, toys to be. Or a lot of people don't have that room to have a wonderful home office. So what I've really encouraged people to do is to understand that a dining room table happens to be the exact same height as a desk. So why not have it be a convertible space? Use it as your home office, then have some cabinets in there that hide a printer, scanner, fax, that hide office stuff, so that in an instant you can convert that home office into a dining room if you need to.
Excellent idea. We'll be back in conversation with interior design expert Vern Yip in just a moment. This is Valerie Jackson in conversation with the Home and Garden TV host and design judge, Vern Yip. In this next segment, we ask him about redesigning a home for families with new children, those that have in-laws coming to live, and like myself, the empty nester. Well, as a widow and an empty nester, I'm struggling with the issue of downsizing now, or as some people say, smart sizing. So what are your suggestions for that in terms of how does one go about downsizing?
I think that's a really exciting thing to be able to do. I think a lot of people will find a new sense of freedom from downsizing because we are all magnets for things. Things just accrue in our space. And I often say to people, you know, downsizing or smart sizing doesn't mean getting rid of everything, but it means getting rid of the things that you don't really need and that don't serve any purpose in your life and that don't have meaning to you. I mean, there could be something that's completely not functional, but it holds memories for you. It means something to you. And that shouldn't be something that you toss because you're downsizing. You should just get rid of the things that no longer hold meaning for you. And it's such a great opportunity, too, to take advantage of this huge trend in design where we are all seeing furniture that is multifunctional, things that have many, many purposes that make smart sizing and downsizing much more doable. So look for things like end tables or bedside tables that have drawers and closed storage, you know, so that you have places to put things and hide things. Things like open bookshelves, for example, aren't necessarily the smartest thing to have if you are smart sizing or downsizing because they don't have any ability for you to put something away and just shut the doors. A lot of times when people look at bookshelves, they look at them in the store or they look at them in a catalog. And of course, the way that they're shown in the store, everything on the bookshelf is white. And there are three books, and those three books are wrapped in white paper. Well, guess what? Your books are probably not wrapped in white paper, and you probably have more than three of them. So, you know, try and get yourself away from things that force you to have to display and get things in your life that are going to be workhorses, that are going to be multifunctional and durable and that will give you the opportunity to put things away neatly and cleanly.
You know, while some of us are downsizing, there are those who found that they've got to expand or adjust their homes because either a grown child is returning or never left in the first place, or an elderly parent that might be in need of supervision might be coming back into the house. What's your advice for them?
I would say, again, really look at before you make that decision to expand your envelope and go for an addition or go for an expansion, look at how you're using your existing space and make that decision as to whether or not you need those spaces to be what they are. When somebody has the label of living room on a space and dining room on a space, it's just that, it's a label. And it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that that's what that space has to be. So think about, you know, whether or not you can accommodate that returning parent or that returning child or whoever it is that might be moving back into your house in one of your existing spaces before you go down the road of expansion.
Well, before we run out of time, I want to play a little game with you. I want to do some little quick responses, give you a word, and you tell me the first few thoughts that come into your mind about it, like the word design.
Joy. It's what I think about first thing in the morning after I get my kids up. It, you know, for me, it design is not, again, about just making things aesthetically pleasing. Design has the power to change somebody's life.
Mm-hmm. Lighting.
Critical. Lighting is so overlooked, and it is one of our most powerful instruments as designers is to be able to light a space correctly.
Well, why is lighting so critical? And if you see something, you see it. Why? What is it about the light that has to be so particular?
Because as human beings, we are sensitive to light, and light has the ability to create atmosphere in a space. It sets the mood and the tone.
Mm-hmm. Texture.
Warm. Texture is one of those tools that we use to convert a house into a home. We just appreciate textures. You know, they make us feel comfortable. And they're also really great at hiding stains and, absorbing noise and all those good things.
And adding a different element or dimension, if you will, especially if you've got neutral tones, a lot of the same tones, a texture thrown in there does something.
Absolutely. If you have a monochromatic scheme or you're that person who just loves neutrals, textures really can kind of add shadow lines and interest, and it's really a wonderful thing to have.
Wallpaper.
big. Wallpaper has come back in a big way. And we're not talking about your grandmother's wallpaper where there are milkmaids and ducks. This is a different wallpaper. You know, we have beautiful, in fact, it's actually not called wallpaper anymore. It's called wall covering.
Oh.
And it's made out of wood veneer. It's made out of crystal beads. It's made out of, you know, hand embroidered elements. I mean, it's come a long way.
Feng shui.
Logical, you know, is what I would say. So much of feng shui is based on logic. It's about how you get from A to B. I think a lot of it's valuable in terms of creating zen-like, sensible space. A lot of it I don't necessarily subscribe to, but I think a lot of it is, it just boils down to pure logic.
Have you ever used it in your work?
I do, but not in not in a way that specifically says, oh, I'm following the principles of feng shui. I follow the principles that make sense.
Rook versus wall-to-wall carpeting.
You know, I think it's really nice to have rugs and to have that texture in every space. I just think it depends on you and what you really love. A lot of people don't know this, but one of the most economical ways to get a rug that's correctly sized for a room is to go to your local carpet store and have them bind or serge a piece of carpet into a rug that's sized exactly for your space. And to figure out how to do that, measure the overall width of your room, measure the overall length of your room, and subtract 2 feet from each dimension, and that should give you the right size. Now, sometimes we have a situation in a room where we have a hearth of a fireplace, and in that case, you want to measure to the edge of the hearth. You don't want to go to the full length or the width of the room. But it's very, very hard to get a rug exactly the right size that's a standard size, and so this is one way to do it, and it's oftentimes cheaper than buying a rug.
Passé trends.
Trends come and go. You know, trends are specifically designed to get you to go buy something. So, you know, at the end of the day, I tell people, if you happen to genuinely love that trend, great. Embrace it, include it in your home. But if you are feeling the pressure to include something in your home just because it's trendy, don't do it. A better rule of thumb is to buy things that you love, things that move you, that mean something to you. If you love it, then find a way to have it in your home.
I've heard you say, add architecture into a space. How does one do this? Is it something that has to be up on a wall or a mantle, or can you do it freestanding? How does one add architecture to a room?
You, when I say that, what I'm talking about are all these rooms out there that don't have detail, that don't have shadow lines. And you can add architecture through molding and dimension. You're just trying to create something substantial in a space on its own. And so usually it's applying something to the walls. Sometimes you can add architecture to a space by a great pendant fixture that floats in the middle of the room that has some dimension. When a room is well designed, it has dimension, it has scale, it has proportion, you know, it has all of those things in balance. And so adding architecture into a space is one way that we create that balance.
Well, you're the proud father of two young ones under, what, 3 or 4 years old now?
Yeah, our son's going to be 3 in January and our daughter's going to be 2 in March.
So in what way, if any, has the presence of young children influenced or changed your design inclinations?
You know, not really at all. I grew up in a, I guess, sort of a unusual way. We did not have rooms that were off limit to me as a child. And I broke plenty of things that I'm sure my mother wished I hadn't broken. But she felt very strongly that it was part of the learning process and that, you know, she needed to tell me what I needed to be gentle with, what I needed to touch carefully, and what I needed to just look at and not touch. And sometimes I didn't obey, and the result was something was broken, but that was part of the lesson. And I'm raising my children the same way. You know, at the end of the day, do I want to lose something? No, but they're just things. And I would much rather my children learn to appreciate things and to learn what it is that they can touch and what it is that they need to handle carefully and what it is that they need to just look at. And it's been great, you know.
How can one create a stylish home that's also kid and dog friendly? Because I know you've got about three or four dogs, too. Particular fabrics or what? How do you deal with that?
Well, we, in addition to the two children, we also live with four dogs, all adopted. Smallest one is about 65 pounds.
Oh.
The largest one's 115 pounds. We live with about 350 pounds of dog. And it can be a lot, actually over 350. But, you know, for me, it's the same principle with the dogs. You know, the dogs know what not to go on. It's important that they understand what their boundaries are. And
so you use like outdoor fabrics and things on your furniture, or do you use regular cotton? And
no, you know, for our family room, which is the room that we spend the most mm-hmm. time in, mm-hmm. You know, my sofas in that room are made out of leather.
Ah, okay.
And I think that's really helpful. You know, our side tables have glass tops to them, so I'm not constantly searching for a coaster.
Right. Let me ask you this. With more fathers assuming custody of children and creating a home for them, have men started to demonstrate a little bit more interest or sensitivity to the aesthetics of the home?
Oh, my goodness. 100%.
Really?
Yeah, men definitely have an opinion. I cannot tell you how many homes that I've had the privilege to go into for television shows where the man has said to me, boy, I just wish I felt more comfortable in the master bedroom with the decor, or I wish that when I walked into the living room, it felt more like me. And I always think that it's passé to say that, oh, men don't care what the house looks like. Everybody cares what their environment looks like. You know, I mean, do they want to fuss over it? Probably not. But at the end of the day, you know, everybody wants to walk through the door and feel like, ah, I'm comfortable here. You know, I like it here. It feels good to me.
So speak up, man. Right?
Well, they are speaking up.
Great.
They are.
Well, before we go, I want to mention one more thing to you, and that's your very special relationship with your mother. You mentioned her earlier, Vera Yip, whom you've established a scholarship in honor of. Tell us quickly about her and your visits to the botanical garden with her when she was young or when you were young.
My mother, up until she passed, was absolutely my best friend. She was my biggest champion. She, at the age of 7, she allowed me to design an addition to our house, and then she got it permitted and built. Mm-hmm. She asked me to design my own bedroom furniture, which I, for whatever reason, I thought it would be great to have furniture made out of steel and glass, and she then had it made. You know, she sacrificed so much for me, and when she passed, you know, my whole life, her big thing was education. Education, she said, is the one thing that they can't ever take away from you. They can take away everything from you, but they cannot take away your education. So become as educated of a person as you can possibly become. And so when she passed, we thought the best way to honor her was to set up a scholarship at the Ullman Cancer Fund for Young Adults, which is a nonprofit organization that serves the young adult community, because there's a lot of support for children with cancer and a lot of support for adults with cancer, but there was a gap with young adults. Mm-hmm. And so when she passed, we set up the Vera Yip Memorial Scholarship at Ullman Cancer Fund, and it's something that I'm extremely proud of. And when I moved down to Atlanta to go to graduate school, my mother would come visit me, and the one place that she always felt at home the most and loved the most in Atlanta was the Atlanta Botanical Gardens. You know, she passed before my children were on this earth, and so we bring them there whenever we're in town. Every weekend, you could probably find us there, because it's our way of connecting the children with her. It's another way, rather. And so they asked me earlier this year if I would consider donating my time to redo the dining space that's there. So I, of course, said yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's Metro Fresh.
Yeah, it's right outside of Metro Fresh, which delicious place to go. But she loved that place, and so now there's a dining room there that's in her honor.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I wish we had some more time because I still have some more questions, but unfortunately, we've got to go. Thank you so much, Vern, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I mean, you are one of Atlanta's most revered citizens, and I consider this a real honor to be able to speak with you.
Thank you very much. And let's keep in touch.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's it for now. Until next time, I'm Valerie Jackson, in conversation with some of your favorite people. This is your host, Valerie Jackson, in conversation. Thanks for joining us tonight. This program is a production of 90.1 WABE Atlanta. The producer of this show is Marjorie Greenbaum. Our technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Thanks to Lois Reitzis and Dave Baroswain for their programming support. To learn more about our series of specials, visit our website and listen to our audio archive at wabe.org/inconversation. Thanks for joining me, and listen out for another upcoming Valerie Jackson in Conversation soon. Good night.